Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, and we're going to be talking about his book, Wiser in Battle, A Soldier's Story. And certainly this is the most important book I've read on the what happened in Iraq and why we're there at the present time. And I'm really looking forward to talking to General Sanchez. General, are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Well, thank you so very much for your book and for being with us, and but mostly for your service to your country over how many years were you in the military?
It was over 33 years, sir.
Well, let me just, of course, I'm well acquainted with your talk. We actually had an opportunity in our December 2007 newsletter to record what you said when you gave your speech in October of last year, you know, about this tragic situation you found yourself in over there. But I'm going to let you, I thought maybe we could just talk really about your experiences in Iraq, because I think this is what's so vitally important today. And, of course, the story that you tell is being the commander over there from June of 2003 to June of 2004. And why did you get so much opposition from Washington, D.C. to do what was militarily right?
Well, sir, I think what happens to us as a nation when we're fighting these kinds of contingency operations is that as in all wars, politics begin to have an impact on what is happening on the ground. And I think that is one component of it. And the other component was the fact that we had an administration and some of the personalities within the administration, both in Washington and actually on the ground, that were disruptive and also were of the opinion that they had to have absolute control of the circumstances and of the decisions that were being made, and that was sort of dysfunctional for us.
Well, of course, I think I know well you're speaking of Ambassador Bremer there, because he tended to block everything you wanted to do and certainly refused to allow you to reorganize the Army, the police force, the civil service, the depacification, policy that was forced upon you, that to close the hospitals, the schools, the shut down all the essential services. Didn't this create tremendous anger and hostility on the part of the Iraqi people towards what they looked upon as an occupying army?
Well, absolutely. I think what happened to us is that we really truly believed that we could go into Iraq and consider ourselves as liberators. And we believe that the Iraqi people would embrace that notion. And, in fact, we disregarded the experience of history that says that just about any foreign army that goes into that part of the world is despised. And, in fact, by international law, when you go in and accomplish a national security objective that we had as our forefront, and that is to eliminate the regime that was governing the country, we assumed the responsibilities of an occupier. So, we had to accept that responsibility and...
Hold that thought right there, please.
Okay.
All right, go right ahead. I'm sorry, we just have to have these little breaks from time to time. Go right ahead, General.
Okay. And so, when you disregard... the fact that you are an occupier and consider yourself a liberator, there are certain responsibilities that you kind of neglect. And that's what was happening to us on the ground. And the fact that we implement debathification and the disbanding of the Army in and of themselves are not what causes the problems, but it's how we proceed to rebuild the capacity of the Iraqi security forces and of the entire governmental structures of the country that were eliminated when we implement de-ratification. It takes us way too long, and it also disenfranchises you know, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that had to be members of the Ba'ath Party in order to survive. And the whole intent of de-ratification was to eliminate just the top four tiers, but in implementation, that is not what happens, because we have a very cumbersome and ineffective system from bringing them back into their jobs. And in effect, what we do is eliminate all of the capacities, technocrats and bureaucrats, that had been running all aspects of governmental functions.
Well, I know reading your book, you certainly suggested that many of the Iraqis you talked to were just furious because they didn't have electricity, they didn't have water. At least they had those things under Saddam. And my understanding is that a lot of parts of Iraq still don't have electricity and water on a regular basis today.
Yes, sir. That has really been an unbelievable challenge for us as a country and as a coalition to try to reestablish all of the basic services. And part of that was because, you know, we did not embrace those that had been running them, but also because this was a very neglected system, and we did not understand how bad that infrastructure was when we went into the country. We really had a very, very limited understanding of the condition of Iraq and what Saddam Hussein had done to that country over the course of 30-some-odd years. And then once we understood it, after we got on the ground, it took us as a coalition and as a nation very, very long to be able to turn on our resources, our economic resources and our political resources, to try to bring about change.
All right, fine. Well, of course, the one thing that you stress is that when you got there, why they started pulling out all the troops. Hold that. We'll be just back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, commander of the coalition forces, June 2003 to June of 2004. And, of course, as you read the book, and it's a very important book, and we are going to carry this book because we think that every American needs to read it and to understand the quandary that General Sanchez found himself in. And he's suddenly the commander there of all the coalition forces. And of course, are they starting to pull the troops out? They're sending out all the generals, pulling out all the staff. And you don't have the men, the equipment, the wherewithal at all to carry on what is continuing war. In fact, everybody thinks the war is over because President Bush said the war is over on the 1st of May, mission accomplished, and lands on a carrier, you know, at least lands there and somebody else flying the plane, but he sort of pretends he's flying it, and it is his flight garb, and mission accomplished, the war is over. And you're on the ground there saying the war isn't over. In fact, it's getting worse. And nobody will listen to you.
Yes, sir. What happens to us, I think America truly believes, the American leadership, both military and political, on 1 May, have convinced themselves that this war is, in fact, over. And what we do by that point in time, by the 1st of May, we've already issued the orders to draw down our combat forces from a level of about 180,000 that we had on the ground to defeat Saddam's army, and bring them back home and have only about 30,000 or less by the late August, early September time frame. And that those orders are in place on 1 May, and when the president makes his speech on board the carrier, the effect of that speech and those actions that we take politically and militarily, in essence, abandons the mission and the soldiers that are on the ground, because Washington, the Pentagon, all believe that it's over and we go back to business as usual.
And because you're pleading with them for you know, staff, you're pleading with them for troops, you're pleading with them for supplies. I mean, you know, when the rest of the members of the coalition come in, you know, from all these other countries, but they're not going to do any fighting, they're just going to be there, sort of, you know, make it look nice, like we've got a lot of people behind us, but then you have to take the supplies away from your soldiers to give to the coalition soldiers, because they don't have any supplies, and you don't have any supplies either.
Yes, sir. And the intent was that we would have a ratio of three coalition soldiers for every American on the ground by the August, early September timeframe. And I think it was important, I know that it was important for us to have declared the war as being over in order for us to be able to build that coalition and to get some of our partner nations to commit their forces, because they were not willing to send their forces into an environment where war fighting was still going on. So that was another motivator for us to be able to convince ourselves and our allies, or our coalition partners rather, that in fact the war was over, but we did it so fast that we wound up imposing some very, very severe burdens on the commanders on the ground and on our soldiers themselves. And we wound up having to take equipment away from our own soldiers to give to the coalition, otherwise they would not accept their missions.
And because the thing that really bothered me was that they wouldn't fight. They didn't want to be over there risking their lives. In fact, wasn't almost all the fighting done by the American and the British troops?
Well, yes, sir. It's a very complex situation when you have a coalition, as I did, of 36 nations, because every single country comes in with their own requirements, their own rules of engagement, their own national caveats, their own national objectives and political considerations. And as a general rule, other than the Italians to some extent, the Brits, and the Americans, just about every other member of the coalition, the other 33 countries, did not have the authority to conduct any sort of offensive operations, and sometimes no offensive operations unless they got permission from their national capitals, even if they were being attacked. So that created some tremendous challenges for us in the South. Any time that there was a requirement south of Baghdad to conduct any kind of offensive operations or to reestablish security or some sort of control, we had to move American forces down there to accomplish those missions.
Well, one of the things
for the British sector.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about Abu Ghraib, because, of course, you were the commander over there, and of course, one of the points you make is very, very clear, and that is that immediately after September 11th, the Bush administration had made a decision, and that is that anybody who was captured, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, would not be protected by the Geneva Convention, and basically they had given the right for our forces to torture anyone they wanted to, you know, because after all they were not considered military combatants, because they had not signed the Geneva Convention. Wasn't that something that really bothered you as a commanding officer from the moral point of view?
Absolutely, sir. What we had in Iraq at the time that I took over, there was a limited debate that took place for a few days in the June time frame, about the third week of June, where we were debating whether the Geneva Conventions applied or not, or whether we were going to abide by the 2002 memorandums that eliminated the Geneva Conventions. And I ended that very rapidly, and in the country, for my forces, which are the conventional forces, we imposed all of the constraints and requirements of the Geneva Convention. Unfortunately, what happens to us is we have other forces, the CIA and the Special Operations Forces, that do not work for the ground commander, me in that case, they continue to use and operate under the very loose guidelines of the 2002 memorandums, and they're operating outside of the Geneva Convention.
Well, of course, you make the point that actually Washington, D.C., the Pentagon, knew about the torture that was taking place at Abu Ghraib prison long before, of course, it ever became public knowledge, and did nothing at all about it. And then, of course, when it all came down, they wanted somehow to make you the fall guy for it.
Well, yes, sir. What happens is that the types of abuses that we wind up discovering and that we had been dealing with since the launch of the war, and the difficulties that we had been having as a military in detention and interrogation operations had been known since the November-December time frame of 2002, before we even launch into Iraq. And it is very well established that we have those problems in Afghanistan, and we in fact had killed some prisoners while they were being interrogated in Afghanistan. Us on the ground, the commanders on the ground in Iraq, are not aware of that, because that has gone on within those investigations have been completed by the February time frame of 2003. They've been reported out to the Pentagon and the highest levels of the Pentagon leadership. But there's no guidance, there's no training, and no resources that are applied to try to fix those problems to prevent them from occurring in Iraq. And we rediscover all of that when those pictures come out. Now, there is, in fact, a breakdown of discipline and leadership inside of a military policeman in Abu Ghraib, and you wind up with the punishment that is being imposed on Iraqi criminal detainees. And that is the military policemen that are eventually tried and convicted. They were punishing prisoners for having rioted over the course of a few days before those pictures are taken. And none of those detainees were ever questioned or ever correction or ever interrogated, and none of them were ever scheduled for interrogation. They were strictly criminal detainees. Now, in the pictures that come out in that CD, there are, in fact, abuses. The Iceman, as he becomes known to the world, is an individual that was killed while he was being interrogated by the CIA, and then he's dropped off on our soldiers at Abu Ghraib. There are, in fact, some dog handlers that are being abusive with prisoners by using their dogs, and in fact, we establish later on that a Colonel Pappas, in fact, gives orders to use dogs in the conduct of some interrogations in the December 2003 time frame, without any authorities, and he fully understood that that was not authorized, but he does it anyway. So there are a series of investigations, very aggressive investigations, and follow-up administrative and judicial court-martial actions that we take whenever we identify those abuses going on. And, you know, as we well know, some of those continue to this day, and it's sort of the nature of what happens when young men are fighting in a war of this nature. But the fact that our nation at the political and the military level failed to provide any sort of training and resources and really response to known critical deficiencies are what I termed a gross dereliction of duty.
And, of course, you would have given the order that the prisoners would be treated with respect and dignity. But, of course, that was the prisoners under your control. Now, of course, yes, were the special forces and the CIA were working there at Abu Ghraib. What about the commander there? What about General Karpinski?
Well, General Karpinski is responsible for all of the detention operations in the entire country, of which Abu Ghraib is one of those detention centers, and we've got at least two other major detention areas with significant numbers, and there are a series of other detention operations that she is responsible for across the entire country.
Well, so do you think she knew at all what was going on?
No, I really do not believe that she was aware enough as a commander, and she was not.
Hold right there, Rebecca. Just a moment here.
Okay.
Okay, fine. Go right ahead. You were just saying that you did not think that General Karpinski was, you know, was aware that she was in charge of all the prisons there. But should she have been aware? In other words, shouldn't she have been inspecting those prisons on a regular
basis? Absolutely. There's no question. And that's where, you know, when we talk about a breakdown in leadership, that's where the breakdown in leadership occurs. It's inside of the brigade and inside of the battalion that she has in Abu Ghraib. and there's a gross breakdown in the discipline and the training. Even though those young soldiers had not been trained properly, we had, over the course of the summer, identified some of the key requirements, and she had been provided some of those requirements from the command level when we had conducted what we called detention summits in the August, late July and August time frame in order to identify all of the things that we thought we needed to do, because we all clearly understood to the highest levels of command within the Department of Defense, we knew that we had a problem that was beyond anything we had ever experienced in the last 50 years. And in our desperate plea for help, we found that there was no one within the department that was capable of providing us timely assistance, and so we were taking it on ourselves inside of the country. But General Karpinski's leadership inside of Abu Ghraib was deficient.
And of course, you commented that very often, you know, during your course of your busy day, after meeting with Paul Bremer and being up at 6 o'clock in the morning and engaging your staff, and then meeting with him at 7:45, but you commented that very often you'd be out in the field with with the tank commanders, the platoon commanders, so that you were always there on top of everything that was happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is one of the things that a commander has to really strive to do, no matter what level he's in, especially when you're involved in that sort of an operation, to ensure that your intent and your guidance is getting down to the level of execution, and that is, in this type of a war, it's down inside of battalions and companies, because they're the ones that are critical to our success or failure. And, from my level, I was focused on the insurgency, and I was focused on some of the really critical challenges that we were facing overall in the country. And there are, as I describe in the book, there are some significant challenges that we have with our force rotations, with just replacing the forces that we have, the insurgency growing, and the building of capacity for the Iraqis in order for us to be able to hand them over. So, when I look back, the priorities that we had placed on Abu Ghraib in particular were probably lower than they should have been, and we probably should have elevated them to some point, and, we failed to do that. But at the same time, we had been pleading with the Department of the Army to send us a military policeman, a senior military policeman, a general preferably, but they... in their peacetime procedures, made the decision that they could not afford to send us a senior military policeman, either a colonel or a general officer.
Hold that thought, would be. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and as you read Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez's book, well, you find out here he is the commander, the coalition forces, but what's happened is he's not getting any help from Washington, D.C., because they think the war is over. It's a peacetime operation, and it's not a peacetime operation. They're fighting three separate wars, and you talk about the three wars that you were actually fighting, and of course, a lot of the Sunnis who'd had jobs, that had been in the military, that had civil service jobs. In fact, they even closed down the factories over there. You've got, hundreds of thousands of people who have no means of making a living. They're angry with the Americans. The Americans have taken away their job. They have no means of feeding their families. And isn't this one reason a lot of them joined the insurgency?
Well, yes, sir. I mean, the biggest contributing factor is when we eliminate the retirement and really all payments to the military, and we disenfranchise the over 400,000 former Iraqi Army and military personnel. And we really struggle with the ambassador to get him to approve retirement payments and other payments for former military members. And in the process of trying to reestablish their security forces, we have such a a slow process that is stretched out over 3 to 5 years, that in essence we're not making hardly any effect whatsoever on trying to bring them back into the structures of the security forces and to get them to help us reestablish security. And that leads them to, I believe, resort to the insurgency.
Okay.
And also debathification has a huge effect on that, because throughout the entire year, we never, and even to this day, we're still having some significant challenges in allowing former Ba'athists back into the core of society.
Because a lot of these were not Saddam supporters. They had to join the Ba'athist Party if they wanted to have a job.
Well, absolutely. See, and that's why, in my opinion, debathification, as we had done denazification after World War II, was essential, but it was really critical for us to have embraced all of those people, whether they were in public service, in government service, or in military service, bring all those that were just the average workers and bring them back to their jobs, and then sort out, as time went on, those that in fact had, as they say in Iraq, blood on their hands. Clearly, the top four levels of the Ba'ath Party, they had no place in any of these functions, and I believe we had a fairly good handle on who those were, but the fact that we just disenfranchised every Ba'ath Party member, and then the draconian implementation by the Chalabi clan-led Iraqi effort, that created insurmountable problems for us.
Well, of course, reading your book, of course, certainly Ambassador Bremer, Paul Bremer, seemed to have his own agenda. He didn't want to listen to you. He was in charge. He was going to run things his way. And he, of course, would not allow you to reform the army. He wouldn't allow you to reform the police. He wouldn't allow you to do any of the things that you as a military officers and the people who were there on the ground felt needed to be done to try to stabilize the society. Why did he block you and oppose you at every logical turn? In fact, it was almost as if, and you commented, one of the other generals said to you, it's almost as if you're being set up to fail.
Yes, sir. It is a very puzzling condition that exists on the ground, because the military, from about the 15th of April to the middle of May, has started very aggressively to reestablish provincial council, the political structures, if you will, across the country. And we are embarking on trying to reestablish police structures and also beginning to work with the military to try to bring them back to duty as units. And then when the ambassador gets there, he stops all of that and believes that it is his responsibility within the coalition provisional authority and within his resources, and he's going to control both the policy, the financial resources, and then the actual execution for all of those. And he really honestly believes that the military, the Combined Joint Task Force 7, which I command, should have no responsibility there in any of those initiatives. We do it anyway.
Yes, I noticed that you actually disobeyed orders and did what was right, and of course you could have gotten into real trouble. I'm glad you didn't. We're going to be back in just a moment here. They even closed down the school, so the school kids couldn't go to school. And
right.
You said, get those kids back into school. We'll be back in just a moment here with Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. Very brave and courageous military officer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, General Sanchez. Why don't you just tell that? I thought that was so interesting that they actually wanted to close down all the schools, and these kids wouldn't be able to finish their school year. What sort of insanity was that?
Well, when it was a second and third order effect of the debathification policy implementation, and out in the hinterland of Iraq, the Iraqis are telling my soldiers, and my commanders out there that if nothing else, they want their children to finish their school year so that they can take their exams, or they want to get their universities operating again. And so we start to do that. We start to bring back all of the teachers. And when Ambassador Bremer finds out, he sends out some memorandums telling us that we're violating his debathification policy and that we're supposed to stop this. And we know that this is wrong, and it would have created significant problems within Iraqi society. So the guidance we give out to the military commanders is continue with reestablishing the schools. And then the same thing happens to us as we establish local provincial councils, because we bring them on board and they had not been approved by Ambassador Bremer's organization. We eventually wind up months later having to, as they call it, refresh all those councils, so because they have to vet them and they want to approve them and put their imprimatur on the people that are there. And that it becomes very disruptive, and it is counter to the advice of the commanders on the ground, and even Ambassador Bremer's own people, in some cases, tell Baghdad Green Zone CPA that this will be very counterproductive and disruptive, but they go ahead with it anyway.
And, of course, you know, just really an incredible story. I think you bring out very, very clear in your book that Iraq is different than America. It's made up of tribal structures, and you want to go to the tribal elders. They're the people that the people look to for leadership, and they're so excited now of something, they're rid of Saddam Hussein. They can, you know, get back to some sort of a logical situation. And then the Americans come in and take away the tribal, try to take away the tribal structure and create a democracy, which is not the way of life there.
Well, that is another probably critical lesson for us as a nation and as a military, that you know, we need to truly understand the cultures that we are to engage with when we go into these kinds of operations.
Hold that thought, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, and certainly one of the things he points out in his book is that Iraq is different than America. Basically, they have tribal structures. Everything has to do with tribe. The Sunni tribe, the Shia tribe, and then you have your Kurds up in the north. But there are tribal leaders inherently. There have been tribal leaders. The family leaders have been in control of these tribes and subdivisions for years. And, you know, but instead of letting them, you know, reform their tribes in the structure of society, as Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez and his staff wants, why, of course, Paul Bremer, representing Henry Kissinger, who he was Henry Kissinger's protege, and I believe is the neocons back in Washington, D.C., say, no, we're going to have democracy here. You can't do it. It's logical. You know, we're going to reconstitute this entire society the way we think it ought to be done. Would that be a fair appraisal of what happened?
It was a very idealistic notion that we took into Iraq, that we would impose and offer the Iraqi people a democratic system similar to what we know in America and in the West. And that was the going-in position. And we were very clearly told that the tribes would have no role whatsoever in the future governing structures of the country and in the democracy that was to evolve and be implemented in Iraq. And that was actually an absurd disregard of the societal structures and the history of the country. And, you know, we took on a significant effort within the military to engage the leadership and the tribes all across the country, and we did that for months. And it was very clear to us. The constant messages that we were getting was, one, we're not being represented within the structures that exist today in Iraq, and two, you need to give us jobs and some economic hope for the future. And in both cases, we would have CPA essentially just acknowledge that those were issues in the country, but we never really attacked those head on until it was way too late.
Now, would you tell our listeners what CPA is, because they're unacquainted with that term?
Yes, sir. I apologize.
No, don't be apologize at all. I've read the book, so but they have it. So please, what is CPA?
CPA is the Coalition Provisional Authority. It's the organization that Ambassador Bremer was leading, and they were responsible for all of the political, economic, and diplomatic initiatives, and essentially the agency that was responsible for running the country while we were working to reestablish all of its capacities.
The point you make in your books, of course, is in America, why we acknowledge that there would be civilian control of the military, but not civilian command of the military. And what they were really doing was taking over command and began to tell the military exactly what to do. Wasn't this sort of a bone of contention?
Well, absolutely. The whole concept of civilian control of the military is one of the foundations of our democracy. And, you know, there has been some debate within our press and within other public circles about whether we ought to have general officers stand up and speak up against administration policies when they disagree with them or when we're given orders that we disagree with. And I happen to believe that that would be catastrophic for our democracy. We have to have civilian control. We have to have military leadership and general officers that are apolitical and that will answer to the orders of our commander-in-chief. But when the civilian leadership, and in this case the Department of Defense leadership, primarily the Secretary of Defense and some of his key staff, begin to dictate to commanders how they're going to deploy forces, how they're going to fight, what they need, and trying to get involved in the operational and tactical decisions and how to do things on the ground, I believe we have now crossed the line into a very dangerous area where we tend to disregard the judgment that has accrued over long periods of time within the military, and now we're being overridden by civilian authorities.
Well, I'd like to get into what happened to Fallujah, because you were there, and of course we know that there were a number of four Americans who were working for one of the mercenary units or one of the contract units and who were killed. And what happened at Fallujah? And of course, the fact that, I'm going to let you tell the story of Fallujah.
Yes, the spark that launches this is, as we all know, is the killing of the four Blackwater employees in Fallujah, and the mutilation and the horrible pictures that appear internationally when they take their corpses and hang them on the bridges. From my perspective as a military commander on the ground, that was an insignificant event, if you will, that it was tactically important because we had lost Americans, but it wasn't something that we felt needed a very aggressive response. What happened to us back in the United States, though, was that there was a very visceral reaction to the pictures in the press in the country, and the administration felt that we needed to respond very quickly, and we had to launch a very heavy-handed offensive to eliminate to capture the perpetrators of this horrible act, and to eliminate a safe haven that had, in fact, been growing inside of Fallujah. The military commanders, supportive of the concept, but the timing was wrong because our Marines were just days, maybe a week or so at that point in time, of having arrived in that region, and the Marine commanders were asking that we delay the launching of the offensive. But the decision was made to launch very aggressively into Fallujah, and with a clear understanding that it was going to take us 3 to 4 weeks, that we would have a significant strategic information problem, information operations problem, because there was an Al Jazeera reporter in there, and we knew that the horrible pictures would be coming out internationally very, very rapidly. But the order was issued anyway, and within hours, literally within hours of us having launched the offensive, the political structures of the country began to almost fracture, and the Sunnis started threatening to leave. The Governing Council, the United Nations, threatened to leave the country. We started getting extreme pressure from our coalition partners, and this led to what I term our cutting and running from the mission, because this would have had a significant effect on the transfer of sovereignty. In fact, it would have delayed it, and probably we would have failed in the stated mission of transferring sovereignty on 1 July, as the administration had determined back in the November time frame.
Well, it seems like this, what happened there in Fallujah, was like so happened so many other places. Your hands were really tied. You were told what to do, and of course, as a military officer, you do it, even though you think it maybe isn't a very good idea. But you're the commander, but everything is being micromanaged out of Washington. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, sir. That would be a fair statement, and they were politically driven decisions. And you know, when we're told to withdraw immediately after we are engaged across the entire front in the city. We believe at this point that our offensive is going very well, and we think we need only probably 4 to 5 days to completely break the back of the insurgents in there. But we're told that we have to withdraw immediately and under fire. And that is when I get to the point where I believe that I cannot issue those orders, and I tell Ambassador Bremer and General Abizaid that if those orders are to be issued, then they will have to find another commander, because I will not issue those orders, because they would have translated into a major catastrophic defeat for America and the coalition, and it would have been a great moral victory for the insurgency.
And so what happened?
Well, in fact, what we do is we come up with a compromise solution where we just stop our offensive operations. But in the end, the effect is pretty much what I was afraid of, that we embolden the insurgency. It is seen as, in fact, a defeat for the coalition and our military. And more importantly, what happens is the insurgency takes hold. We never, up until about 30 to 45 days ago, we never see the low level of instability that we had before we launched into Fallujah. The numbers of attacks almost quadruple during that time frame, and it never goes back to what we had seen in the March time frame of 2004, when we truly believed that we had a great, great probability of stabilizing the country.
Well, of course, you talk about really there were three insurgencies when you were there. It wasn't one insurgency. There were three insurgencies. What were they, and what was each one representing? And how many al-Qaeda were there really there? Of course, we've been told that we have to go over there to fight, because if we don't fight al-Qaeda on the streets of Baghdad, we're going to be fighting them on the streets of New York. But how many al-Qaeda were there really there?
Well, at that time, that was a constant pressure on us from the summer of 2003 all the way, and almost until the day that I left, from Washington and from our Congress, to try to put a number on the extremists that were flowing into the country, and to give them and establish for ourselves some idea of the numbers that were involved. And we never could, with any high degree of confidence, pin a number to it. There were numbers that were thrown around all the way from a few hundred to a few thousand. And at one point, we talked about 10,000 or so. But the confidence levels on those numbers were very, very low, because we had no real way of identifying who Al-Qaeda was. And at that time, we were just beginning to talk about an Al-Qaeda franchise organization existing in the country. That begins to take off with al-Zarqawi in the spring of 2004, and eventually it grows. But there's two other major problems, and now we don't hear about those, but I believe that they're still present. One is those Iraqis that are opposed to the occupation, whether they are former regime elements or whether they are just Iraqis that vehemently oppose being occupied in the country, that element is still there. And then you also have the Shia element that is opposed to our occupation. And in fact, in April of 2004, we have to fight another major battle with Muqtada al-Sadr. So those three different wars are going on inside of the country, and then I also have the political war that I'm having to fight back in the United States, if you will.
Well, who is financing al-Qaeda? This is the big thing. I mean, after all, you don't have a group of insurgents there. Somebody's got to be putting up the money for them. They're certainly not working as waiters during the day and fighting the Americans at night. Who's putting up the money for al-Qaeda?
Well, I think that is pretty much nowadays. I really can't answer that.
When you were there, of course.
Currently. When I was there, al-Qaeda was not... we didn't recognize it as al-Qaeda at that time, but the extremist elements that were coming in from a series of countries. They were coming in from Saudi Arabia, from Yemen, from Syria, from North Africa. All of those, there were individuals that were coming in and that we would pick up. Egypt had a few that came in. They were being sponsored, if you will, by the radical groups, and probably being trained by some elements of that were at least sympathetic to the concept and to the theories that Osama bin Laden was advocating.
Okay, fine. So, but would this be any the country, or would this be individuals in the countries?
Well, at that point, we didn't believe that there were any countries that we could identify that were actually sponsoring and supporting and assisting with any sort of financial resources the extremists that were flowing into the country. It was individuals and probably some extremist elements of the Shia, or correction, the Sunni religion.
All right, fine. Well, I always wondered, why didn't the American military take out al-Sadr? You know, here he's got a militia there. I mean, you can't have a society when you've got a couple of Shia militias operating there in the south. Why didn't the Americans go in and say, you're going to lay down your arms, we're going to have a peaceful community, and you can't have your own little militia here?
Well, that was a... It sounds like a very simple process. The whole disarming, demobilization, and reintegration of militias was a significant problem in that country, because you know this is another one of those things that we as Americans just don't understand the complexity of it in the country, because it's like every tribe has its own little militia, every political party has its militia, every in some cases, religious leaders have their own little militias. And in Muqtada al-Sadr's case, he has the ability, because of his father's legacy, he has the ability to turn on literally tens of thousands of Shia almost on a moment's notice through a sermon. and get them to take up arms against us. And he, in the August of 2003 time frame, by that point in time, we realized that he is a problem, and that is the first time that we discussed the possibility of arresting him and going after his militia.
Hold that thought for a minute. Our guest is Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, General, certainly, what happened? I mean, why didn't you go ahead with it? Did you just feel that this might just create all the more hatred for America?
Well, what happens to us initially, there's three opportunities for us to take out al-Sadr. One is in August of 2003, and in that case, the military is not prepared because it would have fractured our coalition division that was just going into the sector, and it would have been catastrophic for the coalition, because they had been on the ground only for about 5 days, and they were not prepared for it. So I recommend against it at that point in time. In November, we go back to Ambassador Bremer, and we had been planning and conducting our intelligence operations, and we're prepared to do it, but the decision is made, the political decision is made that we are not going to move forward with it because we had just announced the transfer of sovereignty, and it would create some major instability that we, as a political leadership, do not want. The next opportunity, of course, is in April of 2004, and we are prepared. We know exactly where he is. We've conducted all of our operations. All we need is the execute order from the president to take Muqtada al-Sadr down, and we're told that we are going to back away once again from the mission that the president had approved of either capturing or killing Muqtada al-Sadr. And we do it with a complete understanding that we are not to create any condition on the ground that might even come close to us having to engage Muqtada al-Sadr. And America at that point decides that we're just going to hand the problem off to the Iraqis, and they're the ones that are going to have to solve it.
Well, Chris, one of the things I enjoyed about your book was your protestation of faith and the fact that you were not ashamed to talk, you know, in your speeches and your addresses to the servicemen about your personal relationship with our Lord. And that certainly gave me a great deal of understanding of why you were a great soldier.
Well, sir, that is, in fact, you know, I am a man of tremendous faith, and I have experienced, as I lay out in my book, I've had a journey of faith throughout my whole life, and it is something that that I have absolutely believed, and I've communicated to my subordinates that in the business and the profession that we are in, there come times when you know, our responsibilities and our challenges and our requirements are so hard and so complex that, you know, we don't have a choice but to depend on our Lord.
Amen to that. We're out of time, General. Hold just a moment here, and we'll just bring our... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest has been Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, and certainly we recommend his book, Wiser in Battle. We'll be carrying the book because we think it's important. And not only that, but it has a strong Christian testimony, a great deal about the general's personal faith. And I'm sorry that time limitations prevent us from getting into that. General, I do actually four different networks, and I will be calling your scheduler and see if we can get you back onto some of the others. I want all of our listeners to hear your story.
Okay, sir.
Thank you so very much for what you've done and for your dedication to our country and for your dedication to our Lord.
Thank you very much, sir. God bless.
And you too. Bye-bye. And, Chris, this is an amazing book about an amazing man. For those of you who'd like to know a little bit more about Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, I suggest my December 2007 letter. And basically, it is simply a speech that he gave in October of last year. I had a hard time tracking down his speech. His book is not getting the coverage it should. And you find out, of course, that the people in Washington, D.C. did everything wrong, and they created this total chaos. And as he says in his book, Lieutenant General Sanchez says in his book, one of the other generals said to him, "You have been set up. It looks like you've been set up to fail." you've been set up to fail, and this is what it was all about. Of course, they had no intention of bringing peace and stability to Iraq, and when you read the book, you'll get that information. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we do hope that many of you will want to get some of the material we have. First of all, you can call 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 and order Wiser in Battle. It's a hardbound book, almost 450 pages. I've read it for a couple of days, and let me tell you that it's a fascinating book. It gives you tremendous insight into a very courageous and noble warrior. And then, of course, to put things into their other perspective, why we hope you'll want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or watch the DVD, Brotherhood of Darkness, because behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces. Our talk on the forbidden secret with the syllabus, for the talk on the planned police state with the syllabus, and the syllabus is important because there you'll actually read some of the publications of the occult organizations that are really directing American foreign and domestic policy that will never be discussed on the controlled media across America. Then, of course, the DVDs, they sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. The DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, because it takes you into the secret societies that came to the United States in about 1640 and are still here, working at the highest echelons of our government today. And I'm talking about the Rosicrucians, which, of course, are manifested in modern-day Masonry, with several million Americans belonging to a secret society with secret oaths and secret handshakes. And, of course, at the very top of that are people who worship a different god. And then, of course, we suggest the DVD, the Riddles in Stone, the secret architecture of our nation's capital. Of course, that was done by Chris Pinto. Excellent, very professional done. These are actually award-winning documentaries. And then, of course, we have a talk Chris Pinto gave, the Atlantis connection. Because what people do not understand is there has been a plan for thousands of years that America, and people say, well, America wasn't even around 1,000 years. Yes, it was here. And they've known about what was going to happen. And they've been planning on thousands of years that America would lead the world into the New World Order, the New World Religion. And, of course, that's the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, of the pyramid, capped by the all-seeing eye, the eye of Lucifer on the back of the dollar bill. What's it doing there? The caption, Novo Ordo Seclorum. That is the New World Order that they intend to create along with the New World Religion and enthroning the New World Leader, of course, who is their Lord Lucifer. You must understand, we've got books written by the Satanists. One of them is called The Secret Destiny of America. It's not listed, but it's written by Manly Hall, and it's available. And, of course, we have other books through Radio Liberty that will begin to give you some understanding of the true nature of the spiritual battle we're engaged in. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, the book I just referred to, The Secret Destiny of America. It's been planned for thousands of years. America would bring world democracy. So pray for America, but please pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Rodney Stitz. And Rodney's one of our favorite guests. He's written a number of books which we carry. Unfriendly Skies, the story of United Airlines and the fact that they did not have their maintenance up on their planes, and a number of crashes occurred and a number of people were killed. And what happened to Rodney Stitz, who was the senior FA investigator on those cases? Well, of course, you find out that when you try to do the right thing when you work for government, sometimes it can be very costly. And then, of course, two other books that Rodney has written, Defrauding America, which, of course, tells you about many of the people in prisons across America who work for the FBI, who work for the DEA, who work for the CIA, who knew about the American involvement in drug smuggling, the CIA's involvement in drug smuggling. And, of course, when they tried to bring out the truth, they were sent to jail on trumped-up charges. And I don't know how many of them are still in prison today. Rodney, how many of those people that you interviewed in your book, you know, the people who tried to do the right thing, how many of them are still in prison today? Do you have any idea?
Well, I haven't tried to count them, but it's quite a few. One of them, just as an example, is a former FBI agent who was exposing drug smuggling and some other activities of a CIA, covert CIA operation, and who was exposing his boss, a fellow by the name of Lindley DeVicchio. And DeVicchio was an FBI agent that was charged with several murders done with a Colombo Mafia figure by the name of Gregory Scarpa Sr. And I have a lot of information on that based upon what the son of that mafia capo told me. Incidentally, his father was known as the killing machine, but he's one of numerous people that was falsely charged to silence him. He was also a highly decorated Vietnam helicopter pilot and lieutenant colonel. So this is one of the examples of what we do with our veterans if they get in the way. He's in prison in Dannemora, New York. He'll probably be, will die there unless enough people will show a little interest, which is not very probable.
And, of course, his boss was another FBI agent who was involved in the killings?
Oh, yes. I write about it very extensively in the book, Crimes of the FBI, DOJ, and the Mafia. I go, and this is all factual from insiders. Matter of fact, an interesting part of this, in 2001, I had a book contract with the son of that mafia individual, and he was telling me about the crimes, the murders that were perpetrated by his father in conjunction with this FBI supervisory agent. So I'm getting this information, and this is straight from the horse's mouth, and of course also from that former FBI agent. So I'm contacting every member of the House Judiciary Committee who were at that time conducting hearings on the murders perpetrated by FBI agents in the Boston office. Well, you know, and I contacted them and told them, look, I'm a former federal agent. I have two sources that have information about murders perpetrated by FBI.
Well, that's off. We'll be right back. Okay, fine. I'm sure you're talking about, of course, in Boston, the Whitey Bulger case, when, of course, Whitey Bulger, working for the FBI, killed at least 20 people and tortured many to death with the full knowledge of the FBI agent there in Boston. Is that the case you're talking about?
Yes. So the fact that I had information about what was going on in the New York office, right from the horse's mouth, and this, of course, reflects on the culture of the FBI, which certainly is of grave interest to the United States. And, you know, not a single one of those members of Congress even responded. And then 4 years later, Brooklyn district attorney filed murder charges against this FBI agent using some of the same information that I offered the members of Congress. But this cover-up by members of Congress is old hat.
Whatever happened in that trial? Did Vicky get charged with murder?
Well, he was charged with murder, with the four murders, and then there were some very interesting developments that all of a sudden, the district attorney, the prosecutor, dropped charges against the former FBI agent, and that protected the, higher-up FBI and DOJ officials. And there was more involved besides that, and that takes a little more time to go into, but I describe that in that book. Incidentally, all the books are available. There's 15 of them all told. They're available at Amazon.com. And, if you want any information on it, just go to the Amazon.com site and put my name, Rodney Stitch, into the book search engine, and you have a list of all of the books.
All right, fine. Of course, our guest is Rodney Stitch. We're talking about his book, Defrauding America, Drugging America, and he's got a lot of other books. Have they ever been published, or are they simply on demand that you can print them out?
Well, now, most of the books now are the new publishing method called print on demand.
Right,
now,
so you do have them available. Go ahead.
The advantage of that is I can update the book and upload it, and the next person who orders it gets the latest book. Now, we still have the hardcover of Defrauding America.
Hold that thought, Rodney. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Rodney's saying that a lot of his books, his more recent books, he's written, and of course, before they were only available on email, but now they're available print on demand. Of course, I prefer to get my books that way. It may cost a little more, but I've got the book, and of course, it can fit on the bookshelf. And so, how many books do you have now that's available to print on demand?
Well, they're all available that way, and that's 15 of them.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to talk to you off the air about all the rest of them. But Rodney has done a tremendous amount of work. He's talked to a lot of these FBI and CIA and DEA agents. And, in fact, he spent a lot of time talking to really one of the most important CIA's top spies, a man named Gunther Rosbacher. He wasn't a spy. He was a secret agent, went all over the world on sort of secret ventures, sort of like James Bond. In fact, I had the privilege of interviewing and talking to Gunther on several occasions, but Rodney probably knew him better than anybody in the world did, and knew him right up until the time he died. And so would you like to tell our listeners about Gunther Rosbacher? Certainly, of all the people I've met in my travels, he's certainly one of the most fascinating.
Oh, by all means. He was in more areas of CIA operations, all over the globe. And now I've had hundreds of conversations with him, and most of them were more or less like questions and answers type of questions. And he was very precise, and what he said I could take as gospel. And he was involved in more fantastic operations like October Surprise, and he was also involved in under orders of the CIA, of course, in destabilizing the government of Afghanistan. And it was this destabilizing of Afghanistan that caused the Afghan government to ask the Soviet Union to send in troops to fight the rebels. That never comes out in the media, but anyhow, and then he had a very interesting wife also, Ray Allen, and she's got some fabulous stories to tell.
And of course, I think that Sidney, when I talked to, of course, Russ Bacher, about the relationship between the CIA and the KGB, he told me they worked together on many instances. Well, they're supposed to be the enemy, but and then I said to him, and of course, I'm a little skeptical of this fellow, and I said, Gunther, that story you're telling me, and he gave me this long story, sounds very much like a docudrama that came out a few years ago with Robert Mitchum called The Brotherhood of the Bell. And, of course, without even hesitating a moment, he said, that was my story. That book is dedicated to me. Well, of course, I was down the next day at the bookstore to pick up a copy of The Brotherhood of the Rose, and sure enough, the book was dedicated to Russ, special to Russ. And so I have no reason to disbelieve his story at all.
Well, I remember one story he told me, and I always questioned that, even though he was always very honest with me. But then a fellow by the name of Lear, he's the son of the famous John Lear that built the Lear jets. Well, Ruspacher told me about flying, I think it was a fleet of four SR-71s to Moscow and leaving one there. And this was during the Cold War. Well, now, this is pretty hard to believe. Well, some years later, and someone who didn't even know what Ruspach had told me, Lear, who was flying for an East European airline, had a co-pilot who told him that he saw an SR-71 in the hangar in Moscow when he was back there for some flight training. So that of course, convinced me that even the most preposterous thing that Gunther told me was true.
And, of course, what people really don't understand is the United States, American finance, American corporations have been funding communism since its inception. As they're funding communism in China today, so they have funded communism in Russia. And talking recently, not too long ago, with a former Russian who was here. In fact, he wrote a book called, I think, Bombing America, Bombing Somebody or Other. And because Litvinenko was his co-partner, he was the fellow who was poisoned by the KGB in London. But this other fellow told me that you could go to Moscow today, and it's an advanced modern city. You get an hour out of Moscow or out of the other cities, and you're back in the 19th century. Russia is inherited tremendously, you know, primitive all throughout the country except in the major cities. And, of course, that is because communism doesn't work. And, of course, we impose the communist government there. We finance the government. We certainly transfer technology to them. It was the best enemy that money could buy. And I think that story about the blackbird that you're talking about certainly verifies exactly that story.
And you know, when Gunther was telling me about having flown a number of times the SR-71, I got hold of a pilot operating manual. And, you know, while I was with the federal government, one of my duties was to conduct flight checks and oral examinations of pilots. So I quizzed Gunther on operating systems and operating procedures, which was quite different from the normal jets. And he had the answers to everyone that I asked him.
Amazing individual. I'm sorry he's not around to give us his wisdom at the present time, because he'd written extensively about the international financiers and the Federal Reserve System and, of course, their control over our country.
You know, a television series could be done just on the information that Gunther had given to me over the years. You know, the average person out there, they're so uninformed of these things. And you don't find these type of books on a normal bookstore bookshelves. And this is one of the reasons the public is so pathetically uninformed about what really goes on. Because, first of all, the books aren't available. I mean, even though there's books printed, they're not generally available in the normal bookstores. And this is where they're really missing some fabulous stories. And these are true stories. It would also help people understand, with all the lying that goes on in government, it would help them to understand what's really going on.
Well, now, of course, you wrote a book on what happened on September 11th. Would you like to talk a little bit about that and what you've learned in your research about what really happened on September 11th? We know that some planes hit the World Trade Center, but because planes hit the World Trade Center has nothing to do with those buildings going down. In other words,
Okay, now, I describe certain aspects of 9/11, primarily the aspects that's never been addressed, because you've got to be an insider to have known about this. Now, and I have two books on this. One, the latest edition of Unfriendly Skies, 20th and 21st Centuries, go into it. But I have one book that focuses primarily on that, and that's called Blowback 9/11 and Cover-Ups. And I go into the people who helped make it possible. They didn't deliberately make it possible, but by their corruption. And this is documented corruption now. And the primary area of blame for the conditions that enabled terrorists to hijack the four airliners was with the government's aviation safety officers, because they knew how to prevent hijackings, and we've had hijackings for 50 years. And there's a particular culture in the FAA, and many crashes, many deaths, and many funerals have resulted from this. And this is was my job. I had the key hands-on safety responsibility in the entire FAA. And this is at a time when we were having crashes every few months. And now, for some reason, I can describe this, and nobody seems to understand it, even though it's so simple. But, okay, I tried to expose this, and I filed federal lawsuits. For instance, I filed one shortly before 9/11 explaining the corruption, not only in the FAA, that would shortly make possible the 9/11 hijacking, but also the corruption in the FBI, the culture that prevented FBI agents from acting on the information concerning the hijacking plans. And federal judges repeatedly blocked me. They did a lot more than that, but then after 9/11, I filed one last action, and old U.S. District Judge Michael Mukasey, he's now our U.S. Attorney General, he blocked the filing of that lawsuit for 13 months, and it wasn't until after I sent letters to each of the members of the U.S. Supreme Court advising them of the latest obstruction of justice by federal judges that finally Mukasey allowed the complaint to be filed. And the complaint was primarily seeking to report criminal activities to a federal judge as required by the federal crime reporting statute. But there's a lot more to this. And as far as the buildings, what made them come down, now I have a whole chapter in there addressing all of the conspiracy theories. Remember, I've been in the aviation game as a professional.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Rodney Stitz right here at Radio Liberty. All right, Rodney, I'd like you to get your thought on why those buildings came down.
Not going to agree with what I think you're going to come up with now.
No, I want to know what you think. I know what I think. I'd like people to hear what you think.
Well, I go into great details on that. For instance, I address different conspiracy theories. Like, let's say, the explosives. Well, first of all, you would have had to have several 18-wheelers full of explosives to be putting explosives in all that building. And then, of course, we got the people who would be aware of this. And then, of course, you got wires all over the place. People would have seen that. And that, of course, I would lose. I would be laughed out of the room if I was to even imply any of these wild conspiracy theories. If I spoke before, the Society of Air Safety Investigators, that's an air worldwide safety group of which I was one of the original founders. I'd lose all credibility if I... That's okay, if people want to hear conspiracies. But anybody that's a professional, you don't want to be associated with that, believe me.
Well, why did Building 7 come down? I've never understood why Building 7 came
down.
Well,
that was very simple. First of all, no other high-rise was ever built like that. And each floor was supported by certain brackets. Well, once those brackets were heated, and they don't have to melt, they just had to be heated, and they lost their strength. And once one floor falls onto the next, well, now that automatically exceeds the strength of those brackets. So it just pancakes all the way down. And it's really very simple.
But why suddenly there's no other building, in steel-reinforced building in all history that's ever come down like that?
No, because they've never been built that way.
I see.
That's the only, those were the only buildings that has ever been built that way. And I thought it was a very stupid way to build it.
I see. Have you talked to any architects on this?
I have excerpts in my books from architects.
And what do they say?
Dan, you got to read the book. I'll be glad to upload it to the Internet if you wanted to download it.
Oh, I'd probably go ahead and just buy the book so I can have it. I'd like to see what you have to say about it. Well, anyway, you think, of course, that the it was the fires there that caused the buildings to come down the way they did.
Oh, absolutely. The way I described it, yes. And then there's this conspiracy theory about a missile under the wings. And I forget, the female talk show host, Joyce Riley, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, she wanted me to be on a program once, and she told me about a theory. I said, hey, I can't get on a show like that. I really should have gone on and in a polite way explained why that was so preposterous. First of all, you know, she was saying, well, there's a missile under the wing. Well, to do that, first of all, you don't just glue a missile there in the dark of night. That's an engineering task. Then, of course, you got all the hundreds of people around, mechanics, service personnel, passengers. They don't see the missile. And,
hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Rodney Stitz has been telling us his views. He thinks that the buildings of Twin Towers and Building 7 came down exactly as we've been told. And well, anyway, of course, what about the fact that the government is involved as far as drugs are concerned? Is there any question in your mind that the Central Intelligence Agency is involved in the drug trade?
Well, for the last 30 years, I've had, I don't know how many insiders, drug smugglers, former drug smugglers, carrying out the drug smuggling operations for the, for CIA personnel. I've had FBI agents, CIA agents, DEA agents, all describing to me the drug smuggling by the CIA and the protection of it by the Department of Justice. Remember, we have 16 intelligence agencies, and they surely knew about the widespread drug smuggling. And there's been, not only do I have all of these insiders, first of all, as an airline pilot, I even talked to pilots years ago who told me about the drug smuggling. And then there's been many books written about it. Now, for that to exist and the public not knowing about it, it takes a lot of people to cover up. Now, cover up like this is obstruction of justice. And that's the Department of Justice personnel, the other, all 16 intelligence agencies, the media people who knew about it. So,
It really would take thousands of people knowing about it and simply covering up this vast network, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, and then a lot of the drug flights landed at military fields and offloaded at military fields. And this is, of course, I'm getting this over a period of years from the people who flew the drugs. And Gunter Rusbacher was also told me about numerous instances, and I write about that in the book, on his knowledge of it. So, I mean, for this to be going on, and this is only one area of really subversive activities against the United States and the American people, and yet 90% of the American people know nothing about it. How can a seemingly literate public be so stupid?
Well, how can they? It doesn't seem possible that they could cover up something of this magnitude.
Well, and there's no question it exists. I mean, I've been exposed to it for over 30 years. It would be like questioning whether airplanes fly or not. And, of course, they fly. And so it does exist. And this is why the public is so naive. It's pathetic. This is only one of the areas of the crud going on.
Well, I think it's really a tragic situation that we're facing today. And the great tragedy is that most Americans find it so difficult to believe that there could be high government officials within the Central Intelligence Agency, and I'm sure there are lots of parts of the Central Intelligence agencies have never heard of it, but everything is compartmentalized, and certainly, there are only a few people who know, but they do know, and it involves the military, involves the FBI, involves the DEA, and they cannot let the American people know because we literally have hundreds of thousands of people in prison today because they've been dealing in drugs, and yet the biggest drug dealers of all, those working at the upper echelons of our government and FBI and CIA, they are never, of course, touched or never convicted of their involvement. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And then think of those who do speak out, like this former FBI agent. He first reported the drug smuggling when he was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. And he's describing how Armitage and of course, Colin Powell and Armitage worked together. Armitage was involved in the drug smuggling operation, or he certainly knew about it. And there's so many high public officials that knew about it. But whoever blows the whistle, either false charges are made against them, or look at me. Like, for instance, when I'm reporting to members of Congress about the murders perpetrated by FBI agents, not a single one even responded. And that's only one of the areas of corruption I brought to their attention in the last 40 years.
I would simply point out for our listeners, Richard Armitage was the number two man in the State Department during the last Bush administration. So, you know, maybe crime does pay.
Let me tell you something else about Armitage. Now, one of my sources who I became friends with, and he was the head, titular head of a covert CIA operation based in Honolulu. And that's Ron Rewald. He turned over boxes of CIA documents to me, and in there was an envelope.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Rodney Stitz. And Rodney, go ahead. You were telling us that Ron Riebald had turned over an envelope to you. And in that envelope, and of course Ron, of course, had headed a bank there, a CIA front bank in Honolulu, and he was eventually, he got to be, well, the media, somebody was beginning to uncover these secret banks that the CIA had, so they threw him to the wolves. He ended up in prison, but he ended up, of course, giving Rodney boxes of documents dealing with the CIA involvement in drugs. So pick up the story.
So in there was an envelope that Riebald had made, and it had six names on it, along with their code names. And these were names of people that had secret bank accounts funded by the CIA operation. And two names in there that, of course, everybody will recognize. One was Armitage and his alias. And the other one was Vice President Bush, the first, the senior Bush. And yet, now I have that information in a book called Explosive Secrets of Covert CIA Operations. And that's a big, that's right from the horse's mouth. And no response. I think the American public will not react unless they're told to react by some political pundit or the media. And, it takes a little energy to read these books. And right now, especially with the younger generation, if they can't absorb it within 20 seconds, I think it's beyond their interest.
Well, I think it's vitally important that people have access to Rodney Stitz's books. There's tremendous information there. Rodney's a great patriot. He's been doing this for 30 years, trying to sound the alarm, and he continues doing it, even though it appears that not an awful lot of people care. But what's exciting to me is talking to our listeners across America. Now we have almost 60 outlets every single week, and more and more and more people are listening, and they're telling other people, and they're getting them to listen to our programs. And we see this reflected in the response we're getting, the letters we're getting, the emails we're getting from people not only all across America, but all across the world. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Rodney Stitz, and we'll tell you about his website. We'll tell you how to get in touch with the fascinating material that Rodney's put out through the years, exposing the forces working within the shadows here in America. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Rodney, would you like to get your website out or telephone number or anything of that sort?
There's two of the main websites. One would be defraudingamerica.com, and the other main one is unfriendlyskies.com. And there's a lot of information on there, and you can even download portions of the book, no charge. And then if you want to really be reckless and spend $12, you can download the whole book. And they're all between 500 and 700 pages, and they're packed full of information that most of you have never even heard. Now, Defrauding America, that's a classic, but now all the other books then enlarged and from Watson Defrauding America, and they go into currency deals, like we were talking about the murders by FBI agents. And I've got one book called Congress and Other Cesspools, and that goes into great details about the corruption by not only in Congress but in many other places. I have one book called Iraq Lies, Cover-ups and Consequences, and that goes into all the lies and the lies that could be easily recognized before the invasion of Iraq. So, I mean, there's heavy stuff here. And then I've got one book on lawyers and judges, and I go into the corruption of lawyers and judges. And if anybody knows, I should know, because starting in 1982, there were over 50 lawyers and law firms that have been after me to silence me. And about 5 years ago, they even came tried to seize all of the books to keep them from getting out to the public. So there's a lot of heavy stuff here.
All right, well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Rodney, and basically because he has been on the front line of this battle for many years, and he's, of course, been in contact with a lot of people who have ties to the government, he actually gets material sent to him all the time. And, of course, the question is it real? Is it disinformation? And he has to ferret out the truth from the falsehood, because they would just love to feed him false information, have him use it. Have they ever tried to do that, Rodney? They give you some false information, get you to pick up on it so they could discredit you?
Well, if they have, I get some information I just don't use. If I don't have sufficient cross-check on it. But if they have, I have not detected it. But I do get information that I don't use. And sometimes it's not till a few years later that it fits in. Like, for instance, I was getting quite a bit of information about a FBI agent in the Miami office by the name of Terry Nelson as being involved in drug smuggling. While I was getting the information from members of Indian tribes along the Canadian border, I felt, well, I needed a little more. Well, about a year ago, someone who worked with Nelson started giving me the details of how this was done, and the drugs were flown in corporate twin engine aircraft up from the Caribbean up along the Atlantic coast. The drugs would be dropped into the ocean off of Nova Scotia. The drugs would then go inland and then flown across into Montana, landing at Indian reservations and places like that. So here we have an FBI agent. Surely this was done with the knowledge of FBI officials. But if I were to mention that to the general public without them reading the details, they figure I'm one of these conspiracy nuts.
But, of course, Rodney, is there any way that can be proved? Has he ever been indicted or charged with anything at all?
Say that again.
No, I just wondered if there's any proof that you have these stories from people, but has he ever been indicted? Have you ever reported this to the authorities so that they could find out if the story is true?
Well, no, that I haven't. But all these, many of these other things, I brought to the attention of various government agencies, and that would be the I even remember I was filing lawsuits to report these. There's a particular federal statute, it's Title 18 U.S.C. Section 4, the Federal Crime Reporting Statute, and it requires anyone who knows of a federal crime to report it to a federal judge or the federal official. Well, probably I'm the only one that has ever tried to report it to a federal judge. So that's where there's numerous federal filings. Matter of fact, the prosecutor in Sacramento, David Levi, who was then promoted to a federal judge after he finished with me, I tried to report it there. They charged me with criminal contempt of court because a federal judge had previously rendered illegal, unconstitutional orders, permanently barring me access to the federal courts. So this is kind of interesting, too. And they charged me with criminal contempt of court, and some of the things I'm trying to report are the things that helped make 9/11 possible, plus many other crashes in between. So it gets kind of ugly if you really understand this.
Well, now, of course, Rodney, if they did charge you then, were you ever taken to court? Did they ever try to convict you of this, of violation of contempt of court?
Yes. They denied me a jury trial, So here we have federal judges and the Justice Department, both of whom were involved in covering up when I tried to report it to them. So at the age of 67, shortly after I had multiple open heart surgery, I'm in the Pokey, and that's where I met Gunther Reusbacher.
I know. How long, of course, were you in the Pokey then?
6 months. How would you like to do that? And then while I'm there, now I had about $10 million in real estate. I had apartments, truck stops, motels, and they took all that from me. And that's another thing. They took it without any court hearing, which is required, without cause. And matter of fact, they even then charged me, a judge in Oakland, California, even charged me with criminal contempt of court for objecting to it. People don't know what's going on. And I know if you just, anybody listening might think, hey, this guy is is full of baloney. But you got to read the book. And again, I'm not here into this to make any money. At the age of 85, I don't give a damn anymore because after 40 years and with nobody doing anything, I figure, well, if that's what you want, you deserve to have it. So, and it gives me something to do. I write about these things. I write about the cover-ups. I write about the public's apathy. And then the consequences. So it gives me something to do.
Well, now tell me, how did you get out of jail at the end of 6 months? Were you able to appeal this court? Did some judge say, you know, you don't have the right to put him there? How did you get out?
No. Well, they sentenced me to 6 months.
I see.
Now, first, the U.S. attorney, David Levi, tried to get me for a year and a half. Imagine, for trying to report criminal activities. I mean, that should be shocking to anybody. Matter of fact, before I ended up in the Pokey, I was on several radio stations, and not a single person had the backbone to show any outrage or about what is indicated about what was really going on in this country. That's why I figured, hey, if that's what the public wants, let them have it. And they. Look what we have with our politicians out running for office. The public will believe any rhetoric. I mean, it's ideal for con artists. They don't go behind the scenes. Look at all the people that still support Bush. Think of all the people who supported the invasion of Iraq, where we've killed several hundred thousand Iraqis, and they still support it. I mean, when you've got, it's people like that that provided the material for another book I have, and that's called Those Ugly Americans, 20th and 21st Centuries. That doesn't apply to everybody, but it certainly applies to a great number of people.
All right, fine. Well, of course, Rodney has about, 17 books out there?
15.
Well, that's still an awful lot of writing in recent years. And of course, he's totally dedicated to trying to get the truth out. And he's really come under tremendous pressure because he did tell the truth. And, of course, we know some of the people he knows. I can verify that. And of course, we've met in the past. And, well, hopefully we'll get a chance to meet again sometime soon. Our telephone number, if you have a question for Rodney, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I would simply point out that the wicked Chinese communists with a population of 1.25 billion people have currently incarcerated about 1.6 million people. Free America, with a population of a little over 300 million, has over 2.3 million people in prison. Now that we've got almost half again as much as the wicked Chinese communists, in the United States today, one out of every 100 adults is in prison. One out of every 32 adults is in prison, population, parole. Isn't it wonderful to live in a free country? And what we need to do is understand that many of those people in prison are there unjustly because we've lost our soul. And we no longer have honest judges. We have a few, fortunately, and you want to hope and pray if you get in the legal system, that you get an honest judge. And, of course, they will come after you. They will try you over and over and over again. There's the couple of Muslims back in the Middle East, Middle West. They were the ones who were indicted for wanting to blow up the Sears Tower. They were told, oh, they wanted to blow up the Sears Tower. You remember, the terrorists are here. We should quake in our boots. And yet, of course, when the juries heard the trial, on two occasions, they've had hung juries. Why? Because the whole plot to blow up the Sears Tower wasn't that of the Muslims. It was an FBI informant who was bribing these Muslims to come along and offering them $50,000 to go along with his plan to blow up the Sears Tower. In fact, most of the terrorist operations we've heard about in America have been the product of a fertile mind of FBI informants, agent provocateurs. So this sort of thing goes on in America, and how many innocent people are languishing in prisons today, and where is the moral outrage? And I agree with you, Rodney. We need people who are really concerned. How are we going to reach the American people?
I don't know. I don't know what would it take to motivate them. If they would read more, but they don't want to read. So I don't know. Incidentally, interesting thing about that mafia, one mafia individual I was telling you about earlier, and the relationship to the downing of TWA Flight 800. This fellow, his name is Gregory Scarpa Jr., and in the book I write, I go into great details about how he was in prison with Ramzi Youssef. Now, Youssef was a kingpin behind the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. But while he's in prison with Youssef. So he makes believe with to Youssef that he and his mafia group also want to do harm to the United States. So Youssef is giving him details about a bombing of an airline that was about to take place, and that was shortly before TWA Flight 800 went down. He was Youssef was telling him about the bombings in Africa, which did occur, and told him about the planned hijackings. Well, there's a lot of FBI reports on the various meetings that were held. Now, Scarpa then was passing this information to the FBI, and the FBI agents at the local level believed them. But the one reason the Department of Justice high officials did not want to act on it, because they knew that the son was going to be testifying about the murders perpetrated by this senior FBI official. So they all discredited Scarpa. So they allowed, they prevented anything from being done to prevent these various terrorist acts. And this is, could be one of the reasons why the true cause of the downing of TWA Flight 800 was covered up, and so this is one of the things also about the hijackings of 9/11. It puts another element in there, and this is far more interesting than worrying about why the Air National Guard planes didn't get off the ground fast enough. I mean, that you could talk about that till forever. But let's talk about the important things. And for some reason, you just can't seem to get people's attention when you mention these.
Well, certainly don't you, weren't you rather surprised that there were no fighter planes to try to intercept any of those planes?
Oh, well, there we go again, Stan. I go into these conspiracy theories, and I just, I address that in the book, and, you know, we are not that efficient, and certainly not in the FAA. Remember, I was in the FAA, and to expect everything to go smoothly on something that's never happened before is really expecting too much.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, Rodney. Rodney thinks that that there was but certainly in the past, when planes have been hijacked, haven't they ordinarily had fighter planes to try to intercept them?
Oh, I'm trying to think back, but you know, there's so much more important things than to nitpick something like that. But this is what I say. I come out with this real heavy stuff as a professional and an insider. No reaction. But somebody comes by with some wild conspiracy theories, and I remember with Joyce Riley, she and I were speakers at a place in Newport Beach a few years ago. So she was giving the audience...
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Rodney Stitch. Well, Rodney, go ahead. What were you saying?
Yeah, you know, Riley was giving the audience, and there was about 500 people in the audience, about the alleged missile under the wing of one of the planes, and she had a video there. And of the 500 people, I'll bet four of them were standing on their seats to see, and they were taking this in. They were really gullible on this, but they were taking it all in. But you talk to them about this heavy stuff, and you just don't get anywhere. Somehow, wild conspiracy theories seem to be more appealing to them.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, our guest has been Rodney Stitch. And Rodney, once again, how can people get your book?
Well, the best way is to go to Amazon.com and put my name into the book search engine, and you got all of them listed there. You can also give us a call at 1-800-247-7389, or go to the website, Defrauding America, and there's numerous links there to get to the order page. So. And again, you can download portions of it at no charge. I asked for donations to help pay for it, but that seems to be a little hard coming. But there's plenty of people. There's been, I think, about 200,000 downloads in the last year and a half.
Well, that's great, and I think that really shows that there are people out there who are getting your information, and hopefully they'll put it to good use. Well, of course, our guest has been Rodney Stitch. And Rodney, I hope the next time we get you on, we'll get you on an earlier date, and I will call you myself rather than, of course, depend upon somebody else to make the connections for us. Rodney ordinarily doesn't like, is 85. I could understand why he doesn't like to be up late at night, but he was gracious enough to come on. As somebody had scheduled him, but they didn't bother to tell him that he was beyond the program. So, anyway, God bless you, Rodney. And thank you so much. It's always good to talk to you.
Okay, take care, Sam.
God bless. Okay, finally, that's Rodney Stitch. Of course, we carry his book, Defrauding America, Drugging America, and Unfriendly Skies. We think they're very important. Of course, we carry a lot of books, but we carry books primarily of those that you're not going to get through regular channels, written by people who I believe are accurate in most circumstances. And we do have a list of other books written by the occultists. They're on a special list, a special order, but we have them available. We want people to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged today. So we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, I hope you enjoyed our interview this evening with Rodney Stitch. And of course, if you're interested in his book, Defrauding America, or Drugging America, or Unfriendly Skies, we carry those, and we'll have to get a list of the other books. Most of them were only available on download before, which we just don't really care for those, but now the books are available, certainly on print on demand, so we will carry some of those as well. We want to carry the books because we want you to have access to Rodney's ideas. And Sydney, his information on the drug trade is so important. If you have not yet read the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica Jensen Stevenson goes into the CIA and drug trade, really goes into the fact that we abandoned several thousand men, so probably 1,000 in Vietnam, 800, there were 1,000 in Vietnam, and a similar number in Laos. The book Kiss the Boys Goodbye is very important because it goes into the CIA and drug trade, and that book, of course, was actively called here in the United States, and all the copies were destroyed here. Monica got the copyright back, moved to Canada. Somebody bought up the publishing house, and incidentally, accidentally, without having any idea what they were doing, shredded 5,000 copies of her book. We have several interviews with Monica. One is in our four-tape set on The Men We Left Behind. The other is in a four-tape set called One Man Returned. These are four-tape sets, The Men We Left Behind and One Man Returned. You'll hear my interviews with Monica where we tell this amazing story. We have a four-tape set on entitled Is There Really a War on Drugs? Is there really a war on drugs? And the truth of the matter is there isn't. Then we have a book on America's most famous drug smuggler who worked for the CIA. It's called Barry and the Boys. It's the story of Barry Seal. And, of course, that's Barry Seal. But Barry and the Boys, an important book. Barry Seal probably made $1 billion while working for the CIA and smuggling drugs, and, of course, was under the direct control of a man who later became the President of the United States. So if you'd like to get the book, Barry and the Boys, if you'd like to get our four-tape set entitled, Is There Really a War on Drugs? And then, of course, the book, Defrauding America, which goes into the drug smuggling in America. The book, Drugging America, by Rodney Stitz. And then the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. We think it's a very important book. We still have it. I'm not sure whether we have it in hardbound or and these are all used books, incidentally, but we were able to get them, and we wanted to make them available to you. We have it. I know we have it in softbound, and I'm sure we still have it in hardbound as well. If not, you'll have to take a softbound. Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica Jensen Stevenson and her husband, William Stevenson, one of my favorite authors, who thought his wife was had really flipped out. He thought she'd gone insane when she tried to tell him the CIA was involved in drug smuggling. And it wasn't until one evening when he invited a friend of his from MI6, British Intelligence, over to the house, and he said, you know, my crazy wife thinks the CIA is involved in smuggling drugs. And the fellow from MI6 said, well, everybody knows that the CIA is the largest drug dealer in the world. And at that point, William Stevenson decided maybe his wife wasn't crazy, and he participated in, writing of the book. So Monica and her husband, William Stevenson, wrote Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And, of course, it's a very important book. Of course, William Stevenson is one of my favorite authors. He wrote A Man Called Intrepid and many other books. Certainly a very, very important writer, acknowledged on his own and married, of course, to Monica, who worked for CBS 60 Minutes until she told the stories of the boys we abandoned in Vietnam, and that wasn't popular with the powers that be. They did everything they could to suppress it. We have another fascinating book on the same subject. It is called Into the Buzzsaw, and it has an essay there by Monica Jensen Stevenson, an essay by Gary Webb. If you remember Gary Webb, he was the fellow who wrote about the CIA and drugs, and he ended up committing suicide by shooting himself in the head 2 times. He shot himself in the head 2 times to make sure he was dead. Now, the book Into the Buzzsaw, and all of these things available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, our website, radioliberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yon's creation. It is Tuesday, the 3rd of June, 2008. And yes, I'm getting a little bit fatigued, shall we say, of beginning the program.